recording. So strange. Chris, give me some
lights. Okay, here we are talking. I am talking here. It says actual recording is higher than it looks, so that's good to know.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Yep, and then I'm just trying to change my...
Hey guys, welcome to the show. Today we got Chris Kitchen from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Chris, for those of you that don't know, runs a company called KGB Productions. So I guess, why don't you just tell us a little bit about how you got into the video scene and also a little bit about your company?
Yeah, I kind of got into the video scene. Growing up in New England, I was always really into skiing and outdoor sports and adventures. So when I went to college out in Washington State, they had a really small video program. It was a liberal arts school, but you could rent cameras from the college for free, and they had editing software and all that. So me and my buddies just started kind of doing that, filming ourselves skiing and doing some other sports and making little films about it. And then after school, I moved to Jackson, Wyoming, worked a bunch of odd jobs, started filming in the action sports world just for myself and for some of the other companies around here. And then that just kind of evolved into, you know, kind of a full-scale commercial production company, which we are now, which I'd say about 50% of our work is outdoor, kind of sports-related natures. And then the other is, you know, straight commercial stuff, whether that's for a beverage company, Wyoming whiskey, or vehicle stuff, or, you know, corporate stuff and kind of local and regional advertisement. But, you know, our focus is and always kind of has been the outdoors and adventure sports for sure.
Nice. And I remember you were telling me that you guys wanted to get into the filmmaking scene when you first started, and that's why you guys were doing all those ski videos, right?
Yeah, totally. And that was kind of the model of that time. This is crazy. It was like before YouTube was even a thing in 2005, where you would like make a ski movie or a mountain bike movie, print it, film it all year, edit it all summer. In the fall, you would release a DVD of it, and then that film would go on tour. So the first couple of years, that's what we did. You know, we would make this, we would buy 10,000 DVDs or 15,000 DVDs and hope we could sell them online. And then we would do little film tours at different mountain towns across the West. And those were always the best because you'd get together and sometimes there'd be 50 people there. Sometimes there'd be 500. You're all kind of watching these like action sports movies, kind of getting you excited about the season. You know, slowly that evolved and, you know, the media environment started changing. And then we kind of realized, okay, hey, we don't need to put all our eggs in one basket and spend our entire time making this one 45-minute long sports film. We can do all these little side projects. We can do short edits. Brands need this stuff. Companies need this stuff. And we can still do our kind of sports film. So then they kind of like evolve from there. But very non-traditional. I and my business partner at the time had no formal training. I have a geology degree. He has a politics degree. Took some like film classes in school, figured that kind of out. And then just kind of mostly self-taught ourselves to just kind of see what was out there and how it worked. And then, you know, slowly after working odd jobs for 4 or 5 years, we were like, hey, I think if we commit to this, we could kind of like do some of this commercial stuff. We did used to do weddings back in the day, which I don't do anymore, thankfully. But side note, I will say, like, as far as like learning your camera, being ready for the moment and being ready to go, I still think weddings are the best in that as being a great filmmaker, because it's like, it's on. That best man might say he's going to get up and do a speech at 5. It's 4:50 and he gets up, like, you got to be on. So anyways, that's a total side note. But yeah, eventually it kind of became something where we're like, okay, we can make this a career and let's try to figure that out and go from there.
There's a lot of people we've spoken to that got their start doing sports of some kind. They started, you know, they were maybe skaters or whatnot, and then they were just grabbing video of that, and then it just transitioned into becoming a videographer and then getting to become a video producer at that stage. So it's cool to see that you also had a similar path.
And to kind of follow up on that, like, did you, like, having done all those like kind of action sports stuff, and we noticed that like on your portfolio, that is a lot of like your portfolio in terms of outdoor content and things like that. Did you kind of start targeting specific clients that in that space because you had that portfolio, or was it just kind of like you created the content and then people found you and started reaching out to you? Like, what was that kind of transition like for you?
A little bit of both. You know, I would say there's definitely brands or companies that we would see that were out there that we wanted to target, and then other ones would come towards us. And I would still say that's still my model, is right, like what I call this editorial content, story-based. There's a bunch of brands or distribution networks that we target, that we say, hey, we've got this great idea about this hunter or about the skier, about this fisherman. Let's raise some money and tell a branded content story about it. Whereas also, yeah, other people kind of see our work, you know, friends of friends, people start seeing it, you get recommended. We started doing a lot of work for Jackson Hole Mountain Resort, which is a big ski area in town. And that ended up connecting us with a bunch of athletes that then ended up connecting us with a bunch of the different brands that the athletes represent and work for. And then you start getting those marketing people's contacts, and they're like, hey, you know, we liked your little ski movie idea, but we actually have this idea for this project. And you're like, yeah, sure, of course, we'll do that. And so, yeah, kind of to answer that question, a little bit of both. And I would still say, even though I run this company, I always joke that I'm just a glorified freelancer. I spend like half my job is getting more jobs for me and the couple guys that work with me.
It's funny, glorified freelancer. I guess, yeah, we're everyone in this industry, when you break it down like that, we really are just glorified freelancers.
Just under a company name, but still with the same kind of hustle mentality and work ethic. You know, it's the same thing. Instead of just under your name, it's under an overall umbrella kind of name, right?
Just have a higher overhead.
Yeah, much higher overhead.
Right. But, you know, you got to hustle up work. I don't know of that many people in this industry that just are like just sitting at their computer and jobs are just coming in and coming in. You know, everybody's, I even think if you're a huge commercial production studio working with those huge ad agencies, you're still kind of hustling up work and working with relationships with brands and agencies and all that to kind of keep that work flowing.
So on that note then, what do you do in terms of hustling for work? Like, are you relying on SEO, like going out to networking events, cold calling clients or leads?
That's a good question. I wish I knew the magic answer to that. We do a combo of both. I think especially in the outdoor and adventure industry, we're pretty established. I stay in touch with all different marketing directors that tend to move around between different companies. Definitely do a lot of outreach, do a newsletter we send out. I've gone back and forth with having agents or agencies try to help out with, you know, not the greatest success, I would say. It seems like a lot of our best stuff comes from me just leveraging connections that I made and people I met along the way. And, you know, there is those people that see your work that kind of reach out to you. But I think a lot of it is just developing relationships in the community and targeting what kind of client you want. You know, we were all outdoors forever and we were kind of pigeonholed into that. And now, you know, I've been doing a bunch more beverage stuff, which I really enjoy. One, because different clientele, different creative, and it's more challenging, you know, like I don't want to sound arrogant, but like for me to go out and shoot skiing, I've shot that for 25 years. It's like, it's still fun. It's still joy, but it's not like extremely challenging. Whereas, you know, when we're doing these beverage brands now, it's like, how are we going to light this? How are we going to pour that shot? You know, and it's just like, I think as a creative, you always want to kind of expand. And I got into the industry because I love skiing and fishing in the outdoors, and I felt like nobody was really portraying that in a way that resonated with me and my group of friends. But then once you start getting involved in this craft, it just evolves, and I love the craft of filmmaking and telling a story almost more than what the story is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you definitely want a little change of kind of work every now and then, especially if you've been doing a lot of the same types of projects or clientele or like specific industries. You're going to want to like kind of change it up a little bit, and whatever it might be that you switch over to, sometimes, you know, it's exciting because it's new. So you're flexing your creativity muscles a little bit more. And that's like something Dario and I are trying to kind of explore a bit more of this year, because we mostly do a lot of like finance sector based clients and software companies. I kind of like blanked on the question that I was going
to
ask.
I can continue it, because what I wanted to bring up was a lot of people, we've had a lot of guests recently that keep reiterating that it's good to focus on a niche, try to figure out your niche. Yeah. You have a niche. You're well developed within your niche. but you're trying to pivot to another one. So do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think we're always going to be in action sports and outdoors brand. That's just kind of our niche in which we're pigeonholed into. And I do enjoy that. But yeah, I just think, you know, it's exciting to get out there and do different things. And there's a lot of crossover. And I think people are starting to realize, with just the media landscape, you want somebody that's maybe thinking outside the box, that's not in that industry. And I will say, I've done this because we work on big crews, we work on small crews, but like when we're on these big commercial crews, everybody's like, man, your crew is like, work super hard. They seem to know all the different jobs. They crush it. I think like being a sports and specifically snow sports person to start out with, there are just so many variables and so many things you have to be good at that when you get on like a big commercial set and your only focus is like directing or DPing or seeing, it's like, you're dialed. It's like everything seems easier when you don't have howling wind and snow coming at you. But I will say there has been some trials and tribulations. It's hard. Like I always joke, like I could make you the best napkin commercial you've ever seen, but I've never made one. So no agency is going to trust me to do that because they've never seen that I've made something similar to that. So it has been a little bit of a trial and tribulation to get into. I've done a handful of spec shoots where we just go out and are like, okay, we want to target this industry, whether it's vehicles or beverage. And luckily, you know, we have this brand, Wyoming Whiskey, that we've worked with forever, and they'll let us do some experimental shoots at their place. But, you know, part of that is it's a leap of faith, right? It's like to get into another niche, we've had to do some just spec work and just show people that we can do it. Or, you know, hopefully there's some brand managers out there and media people that understand that, hey, if this person has the creative brain and the structure and has done, you know, a North Face holiday campaign, they could probably do my, you know, shoelace campaign. But yeah, the niche thing, it is hard. It's funny that people said that. I was told that too, to stick to your niche. But then it's just like, I wanted to expand out, you know, and like my primary thing is like, I could have a lot more commercial work and a lot different things if I wanted to move to like an LA, New York or Austin market. But you know, I got into this originally because I love the outdoors and I love where I live. And so for me, it's kind of primary now. It's like, how can I continue to love the outdoors and work in it? How can I afford to live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for the rest of my life? And how can I be, you know, creatively motivated? And if that means sometimes I have to take a little bit of a pay cut or it takes a little more effort to get into a niche industry, I think it's worth it. Or otherwise it's just a job that you're bored coming to like half of the world here. And I don't think that's why we get into media to start with.
I think it makes sense. I feel like with people like us, we're to get into this type of business, you have to be a particular type of person. And I think we constantly need something new and exciting to keep our attention. Otherwise we start to get bored and we start to lose the passion for things. So it makes sense that after you've kind of like cemented your reputation, your portfolio, your skill set, and one niche, you're already looking for what's next, what's coming next, right? Because otherwise, like, yeah, you're right. You'll get bored and, like, the passion won't be there anymore and it'll feel just like a desk job, right?
And to kind of follow up on that, like, because you're trying to kind of, like, expand the types of projects that you're doing, do you mostly focus with direct-to-client type projects or are you focusing on building relationships with certain ad agencies in the space where you get a lot of your work? Because I was talking to actually a past guest recently and they were explaining how because they're trying to focus more on commercials, they're mostly networking with people that work at different ad agencies so that they can get more of that type of work from there. So kind of what is it more for you, like ad agency or direct to client?
A little bit of both. I mean, for the bigger commercial stuff, it's definitely ad agencies, and it's just breaking in with those people and emailing them. And, you know, I was just in Colorado on a shoot. We had to do an interview in Denver. And then there were like three or four agencies that I'd been like emailing with. And I just like popped in. Hey, you know, a couple of them spent 10 minutes meeting with me. One person was like, hey, we don't have the time. I know you emailed me yesterday, but I think it's just, you know, pounding that pavement. And if, you know, one out of four of those agencies come through, then they'll maybe be able to find something for you. But it's also difficult too, you know, because like some brands, like it's crazy, all these brands, right? Like a lot of them sub stuff out to like agencies, but then a lot do in-house too. So like The North Face, for example, have done a bunch of work with, like, sometimes we're working directly with them, sometimes we're working with our ad agency, sometimes they've recommended us to their ad agency, sometimes I've directly came into their ad agency and then gotten the North Face work via that. So it's like kind of crazy. And I think that I'm curious how you guys do it. And I've been listening to your show to see how other people do it. It's this like weird network, right? And like media is kind of always changing and all that. And it's like, what do I want to do? You know, when I'm on those big mega sets with like 50, 60 people, I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. You do that a couple times and I'm like, I'm over it. And then it's like when we're on the set with like four or five of us doing our own thing, we're like, this is pretty awesome. There's nobody really breathing down our back. And then after a little while, you're like, but it would be nice to have like more people involved. So I don't know, that's a long-winded answer. But yeah, the agency is a big one, and then direct client reach out. And then a lot of these companies that I've been trying to work with, like they're like just massive conglomerates right now. Like if you get in with Vanity Fair or Revelous Brands or something like that, they actually own like seven or eight brands, and now they're trying to, I found a lot of these guys are trying to have like one main marketing entity that like serves all these brands, but they obviously can't do that all in-house. So then they need to like sub out to get specific niche people. So I don't know. It's a whirlwind. I'm about to release a new website. I have this girl that's going to help me just connect with different agencies and all that. And I'm hoping that's going to open up some doors, but there's no magic bullet I found.
How is she going to help you connect with the agencies? Like, what's her role?
She's been a executive producer for a bunch of companies and agencies over the years. And now is just kind of freelance / semi-retired, and just met her on a shoot and started speaking to her. And she's like, oh, you got to do some cool work. I'd be maybe willing to help. But once you get your stuff together, and I don't even want to go into like the year-long website update I've been doing and just user-friendly and reels and all that. But it's tough because I feel like I've been so busy. I haven't been putting a lot of time into the website and advertising myself. And then if you don't do that every couple of years, then you kind of...
I'm in the same boat. I got to update our website. I've been putting it off, but it's tricky. Are you doing it yourself or are you hiring someone?
I have somebody hiring it, but I have it set up so that I can do the back end so I can change out content and all that. And so since I've been working on it with her the last 6 or 7 months, I haven't updated anything else because it doesn't make sense. But I don't know. I think the last time I redid my website was 10 years ago. So it's like in every 10 years.
That's a while.
Okay. 10 years is a while. Dario's talking about like 2 years or something.
No, ours is I think coming up 5 years.
I've been updating the content, but the structure, the layout's been the same.
Oh, so. Yeah.
I need to beautify our website. Our website needs like a visual overhaul. The content too, I need to focus a bit more on like, what do they call it? Internally linking the words and all that boring SEO stuff that just consumes huge chunks of my time.
Totally. And that's where I'm sure you guys get that point. I'm always at the point is like, what can I pull off myself, or what can I hire somebody else for? And it just, there's always that balancing act where it's like managing the back end of the system, updating content, no problem. Once you show me how to do that, I can do that. Should I do that more often? Yes. But you know, building the whole back end, coming up with the design and what's like cool right now in the community and is gonna like serve me for the next 5+ years, that I'm willing to pay somebody else to do and figure out.
Yeah, you gotta be careful too, because sometimes they might do it and it might tank your website. It's such a like fine line you got to walk between, like, you know, we're updating it, but we also got to make sure it's not going to break or like cause problems with our Google ranking. It's a stressful thing.
Yeah,
I'm not jealous of you at all.
I remember early on when we were first redeveloping the website, there would be like certain things I would be saying, asking Dara, I was like, hey, can we try this, but then he'd be like, no, if we do that, it's going to completely throw everything out of whack, or it's gonna tank the SEO ratings as well. We have to, so like there's very specific rules you got to do, and it's hard to find good people that you can trust to handle that aspect, right? Because some people try to go for quick and easy fixes sometimes. Like we've talked to some people in the past who are in that mindset, and Dario would say like, yeah, we shouldn't work with them because they're just offering quick fixes that aren't actually going to help us in any way in the long run.
Totally. Yeah, I have a great person doing it. She's local to this area, and we've kind of kept pushing back the launch because we want it to be perfect and we want it to be right. And I appreciate that with somebody, right? It's like, don't launch it too early. Same with like the videos. Don't launch it too. Same with rough cuts. Clients are always like, I can handle a rough cut. And you're like, you can't really. Let me get you like a three quarter. Let me get you a three quarter cut before I give you like the rough.
That's funny. With our rough cuts, we try to make sure it's like as close to the working cut as 100%. Possible. Because yeah, like they, like you can't, for example, show them a cut that doesn't have a LUT applied. They'll just look at it and like freak out. Why is it all gray?
Yeah. Especially when you're dealing with financial clients, you have to try to like what they see is what they think is what they're getting. They won't 100%. Understand right away that it's just a pre-working cut or anything like that. I mean, obviously it depends who you're working with. And like, if there's like certain process where you need to get certain approvals beforehand in terms of like certain messaging that you need to get approvals right. for. But as Daria mentioned, we try to keep it as close as possible to the final, or at least what the final cut would be. Whereas like, if it's just a matter of like simply swapping things out on the client's end, it makes things a lot easier for us in the whole post-production process.
100%.
You don't expand it too long, right?
Yeah, totally. The amount of times you send somebody to be like, this is not the final VO, this is just a placeholder VO. And they're like, can we just change that VO and get a different voice? And I'm like, yes, that's what we're asking you to help us figure out. What's your voice? Just merely the words you wrote that we're putting in there next to the shots.
It's just Chris's voice like a watermark.
You got to put a watermark on the video and say, not actual VO.
KGB Productions, not actual VO. Like every 30 seconds, like in those stock sites.
Let's talk about your niche. Let's go back to that for a second. For people that are trying to develop it, do you have any recommendations or words of advice for them? Like people that are really trying to grow within their particular niche.
Like to grow within their niche or to grow within mm-hmm. the outdoor adventure niche or just in general? Their niche?
I think let's just keep it more generalized.
Okay. How do you grow in your niche?
For you, was it like a natural process or did you like really work at?
Yeah, I think it was a natural process. Really worked at it a lot. I think just partnering with different people has always been good. Like working with different people, even though, you know, like I like to fancy myself as a DP director. But, you know, the right project, especially like earlier on in my career, if I could come on and be an AC or just a camera operator on a cool project or meet people, I think that's always a good way to do it. If you're finding people, you know, right, there's that triangle of like, is it good for my career? Am I going to make some money off it? Do I think it's a cool project? And if I can get two of those things to work, then I would consider the project generally. I think for me and when my business partner and stuff here was around, it was always like having like summer interns, having people that are like 18, 19 in their early 20s, just kind of getting out of school just to kind of be, just to have that energy, one, and two, to just kind of see what they're watching. How are they consuming media and doing that? It's kind of always helped. But yeah, breaking into your niche, I think it's just trying to do as much work in that particular niche that you want as you possibly can, and seeking out people whose work you admire and trying to work with them or get on set with them. And yeah, I think, you know, not having a big ego, willing to say, you know what, I'm willing to do this job or this job because I think I'm going to learn something is totally worth it. And just like keep pounding the pavement and saying no. I can't tell you how many times people say no, 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 and then you keep hounding them, and then they eventually will let up.
Would you? I guess also doing those passion projects would be good as well, right? Like, because now that you're trying to break into like the beverage
industry, yeah, 100%. Yeah, you know, that was a great example where we just got paid to go out and shoot a bunch of stuff, and then they had a internal media company that was going to take all the footage and edit it, and they did some edits with it. I didn't think they capitalized on our footage, so we just on spec took the same footage those guys had, cut a bunch of edits to it, sent it to the client, and they're like, wow, this is great, like we should have you guys edit it next time. And you know, again, I'm not trying to steal a job or step on other people's shoes, but I think it's like, you know, we had a vision when we went in there and making that work, like you said, and doing those passion projects when you have the time and effort to do that. That's kind of, one, going to teach you stuff, and two, you know, you never know who's going to see that or where it's going to be and what people are going to think about it.
Do you think then also having a very big passion and desire for that type of work will translate into it, that will kind of bring out like the interest from other people? Because like in terms of like tips and suggestions for people who want to focus on a specific niche, wouldn't you say that is like one of the top things to do, is like have a huge passion for that specific type of work rather than just, you know, being very laissez-faire about it?
Yeah, 100%, you know. I think you got to be passionate for it. I don't think if you're just like, hey, I just want to get a video because I want to get rich, like you're not going to find that success. You might in some aspects. But and then, you know, there's all these online courses where I almost took one and this guy's like, I can get you retainers and, you know,
I all see these those local, all the time.
Yeah, all these local businesses, you know, your dentist's office, your blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, I got confused by like the numbers and the money, and like I have some competitors here that do that kind of stuff. And then I like said to myself, wait a second, that's not the work I want to do. Like I'm doing that just because I think I can make more money at it. Like I think you're right. You got to pick that niche that you're interested in, and whether that's a specific niche or your niche is like, I'm really interested in like cool lenses and how they make pictures look, you know, like pick something, whether it's a niche in the film industry or a niche in the career that you're really excited about. And then you'll probably be successful with it. And that's what I remember this quote from now famous filmmaker Jimmy Chin, when I was considering like working for this other production company. And he was like, man, if you keep doing what you're doing, eventually you'll be really good at it. One of the only few people that do it. And you'll be successful. And now our office is literally in the building of this production company I was going to work for that went out of business and moved to Denver about 12 years ago. And now we're like in this building that was built out as a studio. And if I had gone to work for them, you know, 12 years ago, because I was in that point of my career where I was like, am I going to do it myself or am I just going to go work for somebody else? Then I wouldn't be where I am. So that's kind of a story I always think back on, like, when times get low, you just almost need to like kind of double down on why you do it and what you want to do. And yeah, I think if you have that passion and you find that niche or that career that you want in a thing, that you have a pretty good chance of being successful.
Yeah,
that's good. I like that. Let's talk a little bit about like your team. Like, first of all, is it just you running the company or do you have business partners?
Yep, as of now, I had a business partner for about 15 years. And then right around COVID, pre-COVID, basically, we were kind of like splitting and going separate ways, mostly amicable. And we're still great friends. We live in this town. We like have this weird agreement where we just trade and let each other use gears with no real rental. It's not official or anything. So that was good for a long time. And then we've always had like a couple people that work for us, whether that's full time as an employee or, you know, full part time as a freelancer. So I think that's good. Like I said, I generally always have a summer intern that's either getting college credit or just out of college. And generally, you know, that small stipend or unpaid, but, you know, I give them free rein. I'm like, hey, you want to take out our Red camera, our time lapse system, whatever, like go do it. I'll tell you the place. You can go get it. If it works out, great. If not, no sweat off my back. As we do like get a bunch of stock footage of the area, and that's stuff that is of value to me. I've got a great, right now I've got a great guy that's really interested shooter, kind of spent some time in LA, realized that wasn't really for him. And kind of, he grew up in Tahoe, moved out back here to the mountains. Really great DP, cinematographer, and an editor. And I'd say most of the guys I work with are kind of cine editors. Like maybe they're a better editor than they are camera, but they can operate the camera pretty well and be a second camera. Most of them are probably more cameramen than editors, but they can at least, you know, get a radio edit, rough out a story, get it to a point where we could then send it to finish editor to really tighten up. And I think that that's important too. Like I don't really edit that much anymore. It's just such a time suck, but I love it. I do it. There's this little like 30-second commercial we just did and we had a rough cut of it. And I just was like, ah, it's just not right. And like, I got in there and spent like 5 hours like tweaking stuff around. And that's kind of fun. You forget about that. That actually like you had this vision, you shot it, you forgot about it for like a month, and then you can come back and kind of grab those pieces together. It's pretty unique. But yeah. And then the team is, you know, we generally scale up. we're lucky in this Jackson area, especially for outdoor production. There's a bunch of 1 and 2 man bands. Obviously, you know, in bigger shoots, we bring people in from elsewhere, Salt Lake or Bozeman or LA. But yeah, there's probably a core crew of 6 or 7 people in this area that I generally work with. And part of that is just they're here locally.
Like on a freelance basis?
Yeah.
And, sorry, what did you say?
I was just asking, like, so most of those people are, like, on a freelance basis in terms of, like,
totally.
Full-time, though, it's just you?
Totally, yeah, yeah. There are, most of those guys are freelance bases. And I do a lot of project rate stuff where I'll be like, hey, we're doing this editorial search, we're doing this commercial. What, can you come in and help shoot it? Maybe you're the DIT also, and we work together quite a bit. But there is 2 people that are here pretty much every day, myself and then my main guy, Ryan, who's cameraman, editor. And then we have, like, I want to say AC, paid intern, kind of like younger guy, up and coming. Hopefully he's going to figure it out and really step it up here. But I'd say, yeah, most of our shoots are probably like 2 to 4 people for the average. And then, you know, we scale up and down when needed.
Regarding the business partner you had before, I'm just wondering, because I've been hearing this quite a few times that, you know, there was a partner and then they ended up going their separate ways. What would you say is, like, a good way to, like, amicably end a partnership?
That's good. I think what I learned in hindsight is we probably should have set up some parameters before. Like, we met when we were 18, became friends. Like, we kind of pseudo-started the company when we were, like, in our 21, 22. And then it wasn't until we were, like, late 20s that we were actually, like, making money off of it and trying to have to figure that out. And I just think it got to this point when we kind of decided to split ways because we had kind of different interests, that there was no, like, playbook for, like, who owns what or what is this. And then basically it came down to, like, there was a handful of these clients that each of us thought were, like, our clients. And then it just kind of came down to, at the end, being like, okay, how important are these clients really to me versus my friendship or him? And then, like, if honestly I think I'm the better person for that client, like, why don't I just wait for 2 years non-compete and then see if that client still works with them or with me? Then we'll know the answer. But I'd say I think we were pretty lucky because we had a pretty solid friendship. And, like, I'm in this group of, like, 8 or 9 friends that I kind of went to college with or met right when I came to Jackson, and he's one of them. So that helped out. We got, like, a non-partial lawyer friend involved just to kind of, like, help with the, you know, logistics stuff. But in hindsight, I would say having an understanding in the beginning, hey, we're creating this company, we're going to be partners. What does happen if we split? Is it 50-50? How do you do this? How do you value stuff? Because, you know, like, how do you value future contracts? Like, right now we have no future contracts, but maybe, like, so yeah, that's what I would say, is just kind of figuring out, talking about it beforehand. I know, like, when you first get together with your creative business partner, you think that, like, nothing's going to change and you guys are going to work together forever. But it's good setting up those parameters, just like you would when you get hired for, like, a freelance job, or I get hired to go work for, like, outside TV or something for a month. You know, we have a contract. We stipulate what happens, what the roles and responsibilities are. And I think having that set up in the beginning is great for a partnership. And, like, for us, it just was kind of like we were, like, kind of working in videos together, kind of part-time, half-time, and then just kind of morphed into this business. And there was never any discussion of who does what and how you run it. But yeah, but it was a great growing experience and kind of figuring out, like, what my niche. And I think that also helped me figure out what I really wanted to do. You know, I was like, okay, I love this action sports thing. I want to keep that 50% of our business, but I want to go into some more cinematic, challenging environments. And whether that's straight commercial stuff or, like, some stuff like you guys do, like, I don't mind doing a handful of corporate gigs here and there, especially when it's, like, heavy interviews and lighting, because, like, that to me is awesome. You know, the first decade of my career, I barely even set up a light. So now it's, like, the second decade or two, I'm setting up a lot more lights, and that's fun, you know, and watching tutorials on it and figuring that out. But, yeah, I mean, it's not an easy business, and I just say stay humble and, you know, try not to fuck over your friends, because you're going to end up working with them in the future again.
That's true. I'm curious about the splitting the clients. Like, how do you go about that? Like, that seems very complicated.
Yeah, it was really complicated. It was. And the funny thing was, it's like kind of like who dealt with them. And it's like literally out of like 50 clients we had worked with, most of them were like, boom, that's yours, that's mine, boom, boom, boom. And it was just this like core of like 8 to 10 that we couldn't really let go of. And it just came down to us kind of being like, okay, who's gonna budge on this so that we can make it work? And that just was a matter of talking back and forth, logistics, some of us letting go. And then also, you know, maybe becoming a little more honest with ourselves, like, how much work did I really do for this client, or how much did I put into this relationship? But I think that was the hardest part. And honestly, it came down to like a part at the end where, and I'm sure Sam feels the same way, where I maybe let go of a client or two that I thought was mine, and he maybe let go of a client who was his. But like in the end, most of those clients that I wanted to work with, I continue to work with. Some of them Sam still works with, and a handful of them, you know, their marketing director switched 7 times since then, so none of us work for them.
Yeah, it's the funny thing is, I feel like the client situation might be one of the more easier things to also determine, because it is somewhat more of a tangible thing where it's like, this is the relationship that we've worked with, this is the kind of work we've done. But the part that might be a little bit challenging for some people to kind of quantify is also, who decides to take the name, the company name, right? Because there's also that portfolio and the track record and the name recognition, especially if you guys have been around for so long, right? Like, how did you guys determine
that part is that? Probably easier than the client, Kirill, because with the client, what if one of the partners brought in the client? That's what complicates it.
It was all complicated. And to not get too into it, like the client list was kind of our tricky stuff. The equipment, the name and all that, we just kind of figured out with like, hey, we're selling some of this equipment. I'm keeping this. I'm going to pay you out this. You're going to pay me this. I'm going to take on, we had some debt at the time. I kept the company and the name, but then I took on all the debt associated with it, which, you know.
Oh, that was probably like, easier than doing like a buyout, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know how your production company runs. I don't have like just 6 figures just sitting in the bank account ready to buy anybody out. Like,
I don't think any of us do.
None of us do. So it's it has to be amicable. It has to be amicable in that case.
But when you got employees, I guess you do have to have like a loan, just because, yeah, if you have a couple dead months while you're waiting for stuff, like totally. You got to pay your guys either way, right?
Totally. So, and that's been interesting. I found some people want to work and have taxes taken out and be an employee, and some people want to be just 1099, and it doesn't matter to me each way. There are some like legal things that you have to jump.
Is that freelancer? Does that mean freelancer?
Yeah, that's
freelance basically. So I just kind of I have a really great bookkeeper, and she just kind of tells me what to do, and I just kind of play with whoever it is. And I will say that even though like the two main guys that work with me, even though they're technically freelance, like we have a mutual understanding, like, hey, you're not going to go to like Jackson Hole Mountain Resort or one of my main clients that you met through me and go undercut it. And generally, like when they're taking other jobs, they'll, for the most part, they'll be like, hey, I got offered this other job. It's here. Like, we have nothing going on. Is that cool? I'm like, yeah, it's totally cool. You want to do it? And like, I want those guys to go out and work other jobs and learn other things and hopefully learn better things that I've taught them. And then we bring that back to our own productions.
Yeah. The general understanding when you're working, when freelancers are working with production companies, is that you don't bite the hand that feeds you as well. Yeah. You know, like, so it, like, that's usually kind of like the, one of the main rules. It's like, you're not going to go for the same clients that you've worked with through a certain production company. It should be the standard, right? Essentially. But it's like,
it's not always
like
though.
There are exceptions like that are like due to like very certain circumstances. But in general, that is essentially what the norm is, right?
100%. Yeah. Same with me. Like, I run this company, I do a lot of the work in it, but I'll go freelance for other people, just like DP or direct on a commercial or shoot, and that's like awesome for me, you know, be kind of have one role and be hands off. But yeah, I would never reach out to that client or anything without, you know, the explicit permission of whoever gave me the job. And or if those clients ever did reach out to me again, I would reach out to that director or producer and be like, hey, Jim from Macy's just hit me up about this, what's up with that? And most of the time, the few times that's happened, they've been like, oh yeah, that's a smaller project, we're not working on that, or we're bidding on it, or like, go ahead. Or like, hey, that guy's a jerk, he's a terrible marketing director, don't ever work with him. And you know, I always think us production guys, we're always on the same team, right? So if like I see that like a client's gone through multiple production companies. I know them and I talk to them and they're like, trust me, man, you don't want to work with this guy. He's a nightmare. Like, I'll generally take that advice. And luckily, I feel like I'm at a point in my career where like I don't necessarily need to accept every single job that comes in. There are times that feel that way when you're like, oh, there's nothing on the schedule. I got to take this job. But I think, you know, finding the clients that you work with too is really important too. Because what do they always say? Like, some of the most demanding clients are like the lowest paying, biggest pain in the butt clients. So you got to kind of try to
always
filter that out. Whereas, you know, and you know what you're getting into. There's some of my clients that I know, like, hey, I wish they would only give me 4 rounds of feedback, but I know we're going to be 6 or 8. But I get enough consistent work from them, and I know them on a personal level that I'll let them do that. Other ones, I'm like, no, you get 3 rounds of feedback, that's it, you know. And we just had that the other day where, like, my guy editor, he's like, how many rounds of feedback are we going to let these guys go? And I was like, dude, this guy, this is the 3rd company startup he's been with. Over the last 10 years, he brings me, like, tens of thousands of dollars of work a year. Like, he gets as many revisions as he wants, man. Like, within reason, you know? Like,
but there's a reason you have a salary this month, and it's because of this guy.
But I don't do that for everybody. You know, you got to manage each client. That's the whole thing about being just a freelancer versus being a production company. Is like, it's also client management and personnel management, just trying to keep everybody happy.
Yeah, like, you're not going to, like, the clients that you have developed relationships with, that you work for many, many years with them, and you understand what their goals and needs are, they understand what the whole process is, and they keep coming back to you, you want to help them whenever possible. You know, like, if they ask for a quick additional revision or something like that, that's not super out of the norm, that completely changes a lot of things, you're going to take that on the arm because you want to keep that relationship going. You're not going to charge them an extra round of revision for them to see like a couple shots being swapped or something like that. That isn't 100%. Anything super complicated. You know, you want to keep that relationship going, and you want to keep the experience good. And obviously, as long as they don't take advantage and ask for things constantly. But if you manage it in a good way, then it should work for everyone in that case.
100%. I'm sure it works for you guys. It's like, sometimes you're working with companies and people at that company change and you stay with the company, or sometimes the people you worked with at that company ad agency move to somewhere else and then they come to you with some other clients. So it's like, it's kind of funny in this industry, right? There's people I've worked with a decade ago, didn't even hear anything from, and then they had a project that fit me, or they thought about me, or is in like Jackson, Wyoming, and they called me. And it's the same thing where it's like, where were we? We were in like Florida. Like, I haven't been to Florida on a project for like 8 years, but I remember, I was like, oh, the last time I was there, I called this guy, he was an amazing fixer. That guy like got us vehicles, he got us models, he got us talent. And he remembered, he was like, oh, Kitchen, thanks for calling me. I keep looking at your work, you know, and it's like, cool. That's how the industry works, right? Is you have this big Rolodex and these emails, and like, I'll answer the call all the time too. If people I've worked with, people call me, they have a specific question about Jackson or cameras or anything, like, I probably do it more than I should, but I'll pick up the phone and kind of answer most people's questions, and with the hope that like when I'm desperate and I need that like, you know, red blanket with a cloud pattern on it in Florida, I can call somebody that's going to help me find that too.
Yeah, that's been one of the things we've been doing with the show as well. Like, I've had people reach out to me and say, hey, I have a shoot in like Chicago. That was this weekend. I have a shoot in Chicago. Can you help me find someone there? So I just leveraged the network, and then I was helping them out with that, with, you know, the understanding that I help you if I ever need help in the future, just remember that this time.
And that's cool about your podcast and looking at all the different people. And I'm definitely, that's intriguing to me too. Is like, okay, now I have, with your guys' network, people that you've interviewed and people in different places that are vetted, you know, it's like, at least they're vetted by 1 or 2 degrees instead of me just cold Google searching and being like, okay, I can watch this guy's podcast. I can see him. I can see his portfolio. Okay, great. If I'm in Chicago and I need somebody, he might be the first person I hit up. And same thing, whereas like people call me, I'm sure you do, I'm like, I'm not your guy to help you with that, but try this guy. He's the helicopter specialist, you know? Again, yeah, just hoping that like that, we all we had give that a happen. Little take.
Yeah, we had that happen. One of the guys was like, you know what? I'll just send you a bunch of, I'll connect you with a couple of freelancers that I know. That way you don't have to pay the middleman tax. And I was like, oh, perfect. And I was actually talking to someone else that was going to be the middleman. And like the price difference was so drastic. I was like, oh, this is great.
Yeah. And especially when you're trying to like figure out ways to kind of make projects go further for your clients and for your and for your overall productions, like you got to be able to leverage your network and see where you can do that. I mean, one way is obviously reaching out to people in these different states and cities, you know, so that you don't have to be flown out there, because that always is like a whole huge expense of at least like $1,000 to $2,000, depending on how many people you're sending out, right? You know, that balloons the production budget by a heck of a lot, and it sometimes can make your clients less inclined to kind of do video projects when the budgets go up for something like that, which you could figure out ways to kind of manage the costs, then they might not be inclined to come back for more videos or as often, right? So you want to try to make it as smooth for them so that they can come back to you with more and more projects.
Right. And I want to say something, this might be a little off topic about budgets and all that, but like, I really appreciate it when a client like comes to you and says, hey, this is our budget range. This is what we want. What can we do? I mean, I know we all wish that would happen instead of this just like blind, like let's play this blind bidding game. And I try to do the same too. Like when I call people, I'll be like, hey, this is what I have. I'm looking for a model, or hey, I'm looking for a camera light grip. What do you guys normally charge? This is the range I have, just so people can just right off the bat say yes or no instead of this like cat and mouse game about money here and there. And I also think the clients that get that and understand that and come with a budget range, they know what they want and what they're going to get for it. And so it makes more sense than to play this like cat and mouse budget game. And that's same with people. Like, you know, people quote me rates, great. I'll generally tell people if I have a rate that's more or less than what they quote, depending on the shoot and what we're trying to do and what we're trying to balance. But I think that's something that in our industry we could do more of. And I'm a pretty straight shooter, and maybe not in this podcast or something, but like if somebody calls me or I'm talking to you, I'll be like, hey, this is generally how much I charge for this. This is how much I charge for this. Oh, what do you charge? Oh, cool. It's just like the more we're all kind of in line or understanding what people are paying, the better it is for us than when, you know, there's just the agency gatekeeper just trying to make that money stretch as far as possible.
I can imagine, like we deal with a lot of direct to client. So yeah. I do hear that at times, like, oh, we don't know. We're just asking around. But I still push to get the number because,
yeah.
And 100%. I make my intentions known. It's like, listen, I'm like Tony Stark putting together a team. I need to know like what kind of resources I got at my disposal, right? If I don't know any numbers. So I try to like get something out of them because they all know what the number is. Yeah, they have
something
numbers.
In mind.
There's no way they started without knowing what the number was in the first place. So I always, I have like a 90% success rate when getting a number out of them. Yeah, I can imagine dealing with agencies. It's definitely way trickier because I think ad agencies or marketing agencies really will not tell you that number.
Yeah, because also they're dealing with, sometimes they might be dealing with a project that is like a bigger commercial where you don't know if the budget's 50,000, 80,000, 100,000, or even with smaller based projects where it might, they make it seem like it's not much, but the budget is like maybe 10,000 or 15,000. Mm-hmm. And it can really fluctuate when you're talking to an ad agency. But at the very least with the direct to client, you'll know that they have like a rough range or at least a limit that you can get out of them. A lot of the time they may not offer it up right away because they're also new to it. Sometimes clients haven't done a lot of video production projects before, so they don't necessarily know what's like a standard. And as Dario said, at the very least, he tries to get that number out of them so that he can let them know it's like that should work for you, or you need to put more money back behind this if you want to achieve what the result that you want. You know, there's that
agencies,
aspect to it too.
I think with agencies, the reason why they really gatekeep it is because like they, whatever they're given from the client, let's say 10,000, they still need to make their margins within that 10,000. So if they're 100%. Getting quoted like 10,000 on the dot from the production company, they're going to make zero from that. I think that's how it works. I haven't worked at an agency. I'm just guessing that's how it works.
Yeah, they got charged for their time and their creative and their distribution. That's what I always ask too, is I'm sure you, like, how are you guys distributing this? Oh, great. You have an online partner distributor. Oh, you're putting paid media behind it because you can make the greatest little ad and commercial in the world. But if you're not getting it out there and you're not putting paid behind it or something like that, then it's not going to do what you want for it. So And I'm sure you guys do that too. I'm always asked, you know, what is the goal of this video project we're doing? Why are we doing it? What is your goal? You want to get more eyeballs here? You want to sell this product XXX? Like, how are we going to do that? Because if the video isn't effective in reaching the goals that the client want, then they're going to do more video.
Yeah. And like you said, like sometimes if the budget is 10K, maybe the only money that they can put behind for production, it's actually 2,000 that they've determined based on all the other needs. It all depends on what the marketing goals are, essentially. But yeah, you know, sometimes they'll just come to you and it's like, hey, this is what it is. This is what we have to offer. And that's, and you got to kind of bid on it, right? And see what, where you come.
And it's great. And that's where you say, okay, for this price, I can do this. For this price, I can do this. And then, you know, we have our standard rates that we like to keep and think we're worth. But again, it fluctuates depending on the project, the timeline, how busy we are, whether I really like the project, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's certain things. And then there's sometimes, and I get this too, when I'm just getting dummy bids, when you can tell an agency's just reached out and they need to get four bids and they want like a dummy bid from you. And sometimes I'll put time and effort into that. Or sometimes I'll just be like, this doesn't seem like you're serious about working with us in a bid. And, you know, cause that's the, I think people don't talk about in this industry is a lot when you're putting together those bids or director treatments or anything. It's like the only industry I know where I'm going to spend 4 hours, 5 hours a week on big proposals just to pitch a job that I might not even get.
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. With our proposals, because we deal with a lot of like corporate clients, I have like a templated thing I'll send out, and I'm just literally just swapping out key details, case study examples, and I'm just a quote. I try not to spend like more than 30 minutes on it.
Nice.
Yeah. You get like a system in place, right?
But you're doing more commercial stuff, so it's trickier with that, because you really do got to develop like director's treatment, all that stuff. For us, luckily, it's more basic.
And we have some templates and stuff, but you know, it's a matter of retyping this stuff up, which is becoming easier with some of those programs out there, and then finding the imagery and all that. And yeah, it takes time. And I guess it just depends on how big the job and who the client is, whether how much effort we put into it.
What do you use, by the way, for those types of pitches and proposals? Like, what's
that's your go-to software? That's the secret sauce, Carol. He's not going to give the secret sauce.
No, I'll tell you. Do you know what?
Google Slides or like Milanote.
I used to use InDesign all the time because we had a bunch of templates in it, and I knew my way around it. But I've been transitioning over to Google Slides, just because it's easier. I got a couple templates built that I plug and drop stuff in, and then I do like, which I couldn't do as much in InDesign, I do like being able to send a link and people can look at the deck online. They can get a PDF of it. But also when it's a link online, you can kind of like keep updating it and perfecting it, especially when you're doing director's treatments and you're on like version 8 where you like tweak the color palette just a hair, but you got to send them like a whole another like 30-page PDF.
If you were using InDesign, no wonder it was taking you like 4 hours to work on it.
It looked really good.
It does look amazing. Yeah. I will give you that. My girlfriend's a graphic designer, so I had her create some stuff for us, and she wanted to use InDesign. And I was like, yeah, it'll look fantastic from what I've seen too. But it's like, I don't know how to use it. And I can't like figure it out over the course of 30 hours. I need it like in 5 minutes.
And especially if you're also working with other people, like Dara and I sometimes are working in Google Slides where I'd be working on one project, updating some slides, and then he would need some of those to use for another pitch document. And it's a lot easier to kind of interchange and save like that. Or we could like work on stuff at the same time to develop it further if we need to. And it's just a lot easier in Google Slides. I feel like a lot of people are starting to kind of go into that direction. Yeah. I'm
like 90% Google Slides now.
Yeah.
It's great. I love using it. Very simple.
But when I'm doing like, because we do some what I call editorial content, where like that was a project in Colorado where it is like an editorial-based series about ski industry and careers and jobs in it. And it's for like Powder Magazine and Powder.com, which is like a publication. And then we have different brands that sponsor the series. So instead of one company putting in like 50 grand, because they can't really do that for editorial stories, you get five brands to put in 10 grand. And then you have this little editorial series. So for those decks, because I'm actually asking people for money and getting them on board with my idea, I'll do like InDesign or Google Slides combo, just make it look like a step above. But yeah,
I don't remember who told us about this, but they is sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, I forgot who told us about this, but if they're going to be creating like an in-depth like proposal or treatment, they'll actually ask for a deposit.
Really?
Like a small something for their time. Like, yeah, it won't be like a big chunk, but it'll be something just to like, I guess, make the lead feel committed as well. Because he's like, if I'm going to like start giving them ideas and everything, I want to get paid for it.
Totally. Yeah, especially if you're, because like there is that aspect where if you pitch an idea that they haven't thought of, they might like the idea but don't want to hire you for the budget you're proposing, and they'll take that idea and go to someone else and be like, hey, can you do this for this budget? And then
it's a clever way to go about it, like, and I guess it'll cut through the fluff and you might find some better leads because of it, but again, depends on your industry, who you're pitching and whatnot to. We're getting close to the end, so I guess let's just end it off with like some future forward thinking. Like, you've been running your business over 20 years, you've already mastered one niche, you're trying to get into another one now, but I'm more curious about like what your long-term vision is for your company.
That is a good question. And I think the long-term vision kind of keeps changing as you get involved in it more. But I think my vision has always been, and I want to continue, is to like work with people that are motivated and passionate and continue to want to learn more and do more, and obviously create a stable income and business model. But I think I want to continue to work in pieces that challenge me and make me a better filmmaker while still keeping the bread and butter jobs and the stuff that brings it in. And where's the future? I've been thinking about that a lot with trying with the website. I mean, at some point, it's this funny thing, I think everybody has this idea you're going to build this big production company and sell it, and I think I've kind of like realized that like it's like me and the individuals that work here that make the kind of company what it is. And like, there's not going to be a big payday at the end of that, I don't think, selling my client list or anything like that. So it's like, how can I continue to do projects that I'm interested in? Some projects we do straight for money, and that's okay too. And then kind of keep that life work balance. You know, I would say earlier, I would just do whatever it took to get the job done and work and have no boundaries. And now, trying to have better boundaries with that and enjoy the place I live and get out there and really, again, foster a community. The day that I don't have a college intern or a high school intern or somebody that's in their young 20s working around me, then like that's the day we're going to die as a company. I think you always need to have that youthful energy in there. Just again, for the cool ideas, for what's hot, for what's in media, like, and it just breeds, you know, inner stoke. And then, yes, supporting this film community here. I think like I'm really lucky. This town, Jackson, Wyoming, relatively small, big tourist community, and there's a great group of filmmakers here in innovative and creative people. Also outside the film and just in the arts, and just being able to kind of contribute to that industry and to, you know, keep doing work that challenges to me. Hopefully, motivate other people to get involved and, you know, stay afloat as a business and just get better at doing business, which I think is, we touched on this a little bit, but this is a whole nother subject that someone should talk about in your podcast. Like, just the business of running a production business is like so many things I didn't even know or understand I was gonna do. And like, in hindsight, maybe I should have got an MBA ahead of time and I would have been more efficient. But I do think that like the business stuff is fun and I enjoy that and it's part of the process. But I know that it pays off with being able to do the creative work. So just being able to do that. I mean, what we love about this is like getting that cool new project that comes in, thinking of a way to make that happen, and the fact that it's not the same every day, you know. Even if you're going into the same building and setting up an interview every day, it's always going to be a little different with like the way the light reflects off the person's skin or the tone or the window or the back. And it's just like getting better at kind of bending light, as they say, and telling stories and hopefully telling stories that resonate. You know, I feel like once I get to a point where if we're making commercials or like editorial stories and they don't resonate with anybody, or they just seem like it's just total fluff and I've sold out, then that's probably a time to end too.
But nice.
Well, yeah, put. I don't know if I answered that question.
You did. No, you did. You know. No, that's great. Yeah.
There's no wrong answer to it. So, and there's no correct answer either.
Yep.
Yeah. I can't imagine doing anything else. You know, are there times, and I will say anybody that's doing this on their own, are there times when I've thought about throwing in the towel, selling everything and working for somebody else, or going to work in-house at a company or at an ad agency and just being their person? 100 times. That happens probably like every other year of my life. But then there's that one project or that one cool thing that comes up that you get to do yourself, and just being able to kind of like manage your own time a little bit, that keeps me involved in this. And just seeing that, you know, like, just because you think that job at some company is stable, you know, 2 or 3 years later, you see that that job doesn't exist anymore or anything. Where at least now, and I'm sure you guys feel at least I'm betting on myself, and I've been proven consistent that I can get work over the last 20 years. So, you know, my advice, I guess, to those future and aspiring filmmakers is bet on yourself and be passionate about it. It takes the ups and the downs as they come, because they're all going to make you a better person and a better filmmaker. And that's what our goal is.
And you're always going to push hard to bet on yourself, especially. You're going to see 100%. What you can do to really make it work. You know, when the chips are down, you're going to take the risks that you need to make it work, because it's for you. Right. Whereas totally. If you're working at another company, like you said, you never know what can happen. Something might happen. The company might go out of business even. And
it's not even so much that I feel like people like us can't work for someone else, especially not this many years into it. It's like a dog that's lived outside the whole time. You can't house train him anymore. Right.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. We're wild. We're in the wild technically. Right. We can't be tamed.
Right. And I would say take opportunities too. I think it was like 4 years ago, I had a really good friend that worked on Life Below Zero, you know, that TV show. And I got a chance to go DP on one like 4 week long show there in the desert, and it was awesome. It was like survival Alaska stuff. I loved it. And I also realized I'd always looked at that, and my friends that did that and been like, oh, that's a glamorous life. They just go work for 1 month and then they don't do anything for like a month and they get this job. And then like I did it and I was like, that was a really cool experience. That's not the type of filmmaker or video guy I want to be. So like sometimes it's great to do that stuff. And like, you know, that was 3 years ago I did that just to see. And you know, again, pay was great, felt like a really cool job, but I realized that's not where I want to focus my energy. So, but that's good. Yeah. Take that risk. And now I don't even have to think about all my reality TV camera friends that they got it better than me.
Yeah.
Let's end off with how you came up with the name for the company, and then we'll end the episode.
Okay, my least favorite question. We originally came up with a name because it was the three of us that started it. Kitchen is my last name, Garson and Bayard. And we were just kind of playing with like shaking up the industry, you know, KGB, this like evil, dark, shadowy network that's like, shaking
so
it
that
up.
Was, okay. Yeah, so we were wondering about that.
We had a little bit of that. And then we just thought it was funny. And then at the time, like, all the action sports companies were like Warren Miller, WME, like Teton Gravity Research, TGR, MSP, Matchstick. So we were kind of like doing a play off that. And like I said, I've
thought
about
with the changing. KGB.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a hammer and a sickle in the original logo?
We didn't, but so we just played off that. I've thought about changing it 100 times, and now I just feel like I've got some brand recognition and it's a big effort to rebrand and do all that.
Oh, no, you can't change it now. You're committed at this point.
Yeah. 15, 20 years? Like,
if you do that, you're going to tank on Google. Don't even attempt
it. Once you get past 10 years, you know, at that point, don't change it.
Yeah. I'm starting to ask ChatGPT new things that KGB can mean to try to find something.
A different acronym maybe. Too.
I'm gonna look it up after this.
Yeah.
Like Capture Great... biopics.
Capture with a K.
Capture with a K. That's what I went with.
Because that says professional.
You mean it's not spelled with a K?
Exactly. Cool. Well, thank you guys. I really appreciate what you guys are doing. Thanks, and Chris. Running your business and doing this podcast is pretty cool to see and just listen to other creatives out there and figure out how they made it. Because I think there is no clear, direct path that everybody does. Everybody comes to this on a different path. So it's always cool to hear different people's stories. So thanks for doing that.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us and sharing your story.
So guys, if you want to find Chris, go to kgb-productions.com. And his Instagram is kgb_productions. So make sure you guys are following him on there.
And there should be a new website out like April 1st-ish.
That's fine. This episode's coming out after that, so perfect. People will be able to see it.
Great.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creatives Grab Coffee. Please make sure to follow and engage with us on Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, YouTube, and your favorite podcast app.
Creatives Grab Coffee is created by Lapse Productions, a video production company based in Toronto, Canada.
Creatives Grab Coffee is also sponsored by...
My name is Miran. Welcome to Canada Film Equipment. We are a boutique rental house based in Toronto. We are here to help you guys out with all production sizes. Feel free to contact us to get a quote if you are a production house and you're looking for lighting, camera packages, or lighting and group van packages. You can see our contact information in the link below. We are more than happy to help you guys out. Make sure you follow and subscribe to creativesgrabcoffee.com. Thank you.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm Matt. Welcome to Audio Process. We are a boutique audio company doing location sound, sound design, post sound, ADR, Foley. We service equipment. We do all your audio needs here in Toronto. We got you covered. Come on down, audioprocess.ca. Don't forget to like, follow, subscribe, and all of the other internet things to creativesgrabcoffee.com. They'll be waiting for you. I'll be waiting for you. And we're all gonna have a real good time.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next one.